from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. It's an all-visual arts show this week. First, I'll get a preview of a unique visual art exhibit designed for a blind and visually impaired audience.
Get to find out how the IMA's Contemporary Art Society is celebrating its 50th anniversary.
And I'll talk with an artist who's part of the group Women of a Certain Age. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Visual artist Pete Brown is accustomed to going to museums where the rule is, look but don't touch. But for his new solo endeavor called Blind, Visualize Without Your Eyes, he turned that rule on its head. Sharon Gamble invited Pete to our studios to learn about this interactive multimedia art experience in partnership with Bosma Enterprises.
I want you to start with the story of your daughter Savannah and your trip to the IMA.
My friends at the IMA I'm going to get calls about this, Sharon. Thanks.
It's in the past. They can't, no harm was done.
It is. Well, many years ago, my daughter was about three. We took a trip to the IMA, as I love to do as often as I can. And we walked in to a gallery space, and there was this beautiful George O'Keefe painting on the wall. And there were no barriers. And before I could stop her or knew what happened, she was... had her hands all over it, trying to feel the flowers and the color and the texture of everything. And that's basically how that went. So I'm sorry if I made work for any conservators.
And if it's the one I'm thinking of, it's the Datura. It's the giant white flowers, and it's enormous. And
yes.
It does reach down to a three-year-old's level.
It does.
It goes that close to the floor.
Yes.
So, I mean, who wouldn't? And it's very thick oil paint. Mm-hmm. So who wouldn't want to touch it?
Yes.
Right?
For sure.
Have you? All right. You don't have to say where this was, but have you ever touched someone else's artwork?
That's a good question. I'm sure I have. When you're an artist and you have friends who are artists, I think everybody's constantly pawing at everything everybody else is doing.
Sure.
Kind of with this almost implied permission. So
yeah.
I'm sure I have. Nothing. I never got in trouble for it. Let's put it that way.
You haven't been busted. I'm not a visual artist, but I admit to having touched. Just because something about texture sometimes just calls out.
For sure.
To be experienced in a tactile way.
For sure.
So how did your connection to Bosma Enterprises happen? You've been working on this for a year and a half, but
yeah.
How did you first get hooked up with them?
That's actually a story that goes back about 4 or 5 years. I've been working with the Eitelsjorg Museum for the last 6 years, and I was fortunate enough to attend an AAM conference.
And we hosted here in Indy?
Actually, it was the year or two after. It was in Chicago.
Okay.
And so I went up there, and one of my sessions was on ADA compliance in institutions. And so I was still, relatively young to the industry, and I was totally fired up to come back and, make the whole earth ADA compliant.
Good for you.
Yeah, which I think it's very, 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 very important. And
it is.
So I was able to pull together a meeting at the Eitelsjorg and invite a bunch of different organizations to send representatives over to go through the museum and just tell me their thoughts, what's great, what could we improve on, things like that. And one of those, there's actually two folks from Bosma came down for that experience. And so that was my first introduction. From there, they invited me to tour the facility, which is unbelievable. I recommend that everybody try to get over to see what Bosma's really doing, their impact on the community. And they do tours and all kinds of great things. And from there, my wife and I moved, and three doors down, one of my neighbors, who's one of our best friends now, worked for Bosma, or still works for Bosma,
huh.
I should say. So there's all these little sprinklings of these,
Connections.
Yeah, connections.
Yeah.
And so I was approached by Bosma, by Heather Quigley Allen, and she said, you know, we really want to try something different. We do a lot of different events to promote our mission throughout the year, and we want to try and do something a little more unexpected. Would you be interested in coming up with an art show, you know, based on our mission? And immediately said yes, but give me a week to 10 days to really process this, and let's have lunch again and, mm-hmm. and talk about our ideas. So that's the beginning.
And so you assembled, you and Heather together, probably with some other folks, assembled a committee. That's not something you would normally do as a working artist,
right.
But you did assemble a committee because, well, you tell me.
Yeah.
Why did you do that?
Well, again, I'm probably referenced the Idoljorg 100 times today, but at the Idoljorg, I've had the honor of working with so many people from cultures outside of my own, and I feel that it's really an honor to be invited to work with new groups of people to which you don't belong, you know?
Right.
And so there's a lot of responsibility that goes along with that, and when I stepped in and joined in this partnership with Bosma, it was as if I was stepping into a new culture of people. You know, people who are blind and visually impaired have many things that are specific to their culture and their way of life. And really, I wanted to take the role of a catalyst more so than Pete Brown, visual artist, tells the earth what it's like to be blind or visually impaired. That's not what it's about, you
right.
know. It was about me learning from the people at Bosma, making sure they had a large say in what they liked and didn't like about what I was going to be creating. And a committee was the best way to do that. So we were able to pull from various branches of Bosma's organization. We had bi-monthly meetings with numbers ranging from, you know, 6 to 12 people per meeting. And, you know, it was just so important to hear their stories and hear their opinions on everything.
And you came up with this really cool concept of test boards, and you've brought one into the studio, which I can't help but touch right now, and I know it's radio, so y'all can't see this. So why don't you describe what your test boards are like?
Sure. Well, early on in the planning, the couple of main things I really wanted to highlight in this show were hands-on. First of all the art in this entire show is completely touchable. I'll be offended if you don't touch it. And so I started I started creating test boards as soon as Heather and I started hashing out concepts, where I would go to Lowe's or, you know, Home Depot, Hobby Lobby, Michaels, anywhere, and just anything that looked interesting and made me want to touch it, I would buy a portion, a sample or something, and I started playing with how to adhere them, how to organize them, how does paint work on it, how does marker work on it, how does crayon, you know, and it was so freeing because, I mean, up to this point, my artwork is traditionally stencil and aerosol based, and I've spent the last 4 years trying to simulate texture and depth. And so this was totally freeing because it's like
new materials.
Exactly.
I can actually do three dimensions.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I didn't have to say, well, I need to try and simulate that. I said, well, if I want that to be soft, then I'm going to go buy something soft. And I
sure.
need to figure out how to adhere it, you know. And so it was just a blast. And so I have these tester boards that range in size from, you know, 12 inches by 8 inches, anywhere down to 3 inches by an inch. Just any scrap that I could glue to or draw on or paint on. Anytime I got a new material.
And the one you brought in has some flat things like crayon as well as marker and some paint, but it also has little pearl gems, it has cork, it has what is that foam stuff called, like the little foam shapes for kids.
Oh, yeah. I don't know what it's called,
but
you can buy big sheets of it. I learned that.
Little pieces of wood, a glass tile, some little gemstones, a little piece of mirror, some AstroTurf, different kinds of AstroTurf.
Yeah.
Great textures.
Thanks.
So out of this process, did you come up with a kind of a basic toolkit of, say, 12 or 15 materials that you wanted most to work with?
That's a good question. I would say there's probably 10 to 15 that keep making an appearance. There's a comfort level with certain materials that you kind of get, you know, once it works, well, hey, this is going to work again.
Yeah.
So a lot of the pieces that are have multiple layers of depth, I use a lot of wood, like lightweight wood, to mount things on because, again, people will be interacting with this for at least the month that it's up in Gallery 924, and I want everything to be to survive the month, you know. I've been testing everything out on my children. My kids are very active, and hey, guys, check out this piece. What
How
do you think?
How old are they?
12, 10, and 4.
Oh, my goodness. So, if it survives 12, 10, and 4-year-olds, it should last
that's right.
with folks for a month. But
sure.
But I want to mention that you said something before we turned the microphone on, which is this is a family-friendly exhibit and a great way for people of all ages to actually touch the art, no matter what your visual capacity.
For sure, yeah. It's kind of, in my mind, it's just opened doors for a lot of other people to come be invited into art, you know. I think in a traditional gallery setting, it can be a very intimidating place for people who are not necessarily looking for art. My work is very graphic, and that is usually fairly inviting to people to want to engage in it and come up and look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But from there, you know, just the fact that anybody can touch this, there's all kinds of learners out there. When I was teaching, I did a lot of work with multiple intelligences, and there are people that's how they learn. They learn by touching it, and they want to touch it, just like my daughter at the IMA, and they want to just use all the senses they can use to interact with that art. So it's really good for everybody.
Now, you showed me some of the images from the exhibition, and there are some common themes, including power, superpowers, and transportation. I want you to talk about the superpowered people in the exhibit.
Hmm.
You have some kind of iconic images.
Sure, sure. Well, in speaking with the committee, we were very open with each other. You know, up front, I said, I'm going to ask you every question that comes to mind, and if it's out of line or offensive or rubs you the wrong way, tell me about it, and feel free to talk to me candidly, because this is what we need to do.
Right.
We need to have this discussion, so let's create a discussion.
So it can be authentic.
Oh, exactly. Well, exactly. And so at one of our meetings, I had a list. I'd created this laundry list of people that I had perceived as people who are blind or visually impaired, and, you know, based on my life of, you know, pop culture fascination. And so I said, I'm just going to throw this out there to start. How about Daredevil, you know, from the Marvel comics? And immediately, a gentleman named Ray said, I can't stand Daredevil. And on the other side of the room, a gentleman named Adam said, I love Daredevil. And I said, you know what? This has got to be it. This has got to be a signature piece, an important part of the show, because what's happening is we're creating discussions around how people define blindness, or how people represent blindness, you know, in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of misconceptions that sighted people that are not really involved with people who are blind or visually impaired, how they kind of perceive that lifestyle or whatever. And so, you know, it was outstanding to hear their interpretations of that and to be able to create a conversation around it. You know, not every person who is blind hates this or loves this, you know. There's stereotypes about many, many cultural groups, and people who are blind and visually impaired have those as well. Ray said, I can't stand it. Everybody thinks that I have super hearing and that I can have super smelling powers. You know, he thought everybody thinks my senses are heightened. And Adam, you know, his counterpoint was, well, I think it's really neat that this character who is blind is being showcased as this guy who can do anything he wants at any time, and even more so than sighted people, you know, in many ways. So,
so on the one hand, you gave us a cultural stereotype, but on the other hand, maybe you gave us power.
Oh, for sure.
And they're responses to the same character.
Definitely, yeah. Definitely. And so even within the committee, as we all started talking about different people, I call the concepts nouns, because there are people and things and animals, all kinds of different things in this show. And as we just started brainstorming and talking, it was great to hear the conversations within the committee, and for me to become basically a fly on the wall in a lot of ways. So
you've brought in another one of your pieces that depicts Harriet Tubman.
Mm-hmm.
And you told me something about her I'd never heard or read, something that happened when she was young. What
sure.
happened to her?
Well, with my original research, I was going through a lot of websites and then double-checking and triple-checking and quadruple-checking, because
sure.
we all know how the Internet can be. But
what? It's not real if it's on the Internet.
So originally, I read that Harriet Tubman was blind, and I started double-checking, and I kept finding that was not necessarily accurate. So, but what was consistent throughout my research was that when Harriet Tubman was young, she was hit in the head with a large metal object, and from that point on began experiencing these very vivid visions, almost hallucinations, and also because of that developed some sort of narcolepsy. Huh. And so I thought that was a really interesting interpretation of blind being someone who is blind or visually impaired, because, I mean, really, if you think about her going about her day, whatever she was doing, and then magically having this vision, you know, that would really impair what you were doing and how you interacted with the world. And again, I've read different research about how she would say that she thought that was God speaking to her and telling her to, you know, keep moving forward in her mission and helping others. And I don't know. I thought that was a really powerful piece of her life that probably really motivated her.
You have an iconic picture, an iconic representation that appears over and over, and you call it Death by Bowling. Can you explain that?
Yeah. That is a piece. It's sort of a logo or a representation, I suppose, I created several years ago. And the story behind it is several years ago, my son and I were in a bowling league together as utter novices. You know, we'd walk in and there's all these other people with their expensive equipment and high-tech, you know, wrist guards and shoes. And we would go, you know, and grab our pink neon ball and throw it in the rack and get ready to go, you know. And so after a couple of weeks of that, I said, you know, these folks here are just the pros. We need to hang with them. So I created this little logo that is an interpretation on skull and crossbones, but instead of the crossbones, it has bowling pins. And so hence Death by Bowling. And my goal was, I went to Salvation Army and I bought empty bowling bags for a couple bucks each and stenciled that onto the bowling bag. So every week we'd walk in with this bowling bag, plop it down against our opponent, you know, looking all tough with our custom bowling bags, but we'd still have to walk over and go get the pink neon ball anyway to bowl. So what happened is its meaning evolved, you know. It started changing from, as I started incorporating it into my artwork, people would come and look at it and they go, what's the deal with the skull and crossbones? And then they'd look at it closer and they'd start laughing and they'd go, oh, why is it bowling pins? And we'd start this conversation. And so it evolved into this. The meaning for me is more of an optimistic, hopeful image that hides in a lot of my artwork. And it's because, you know, if you take a quick look at something, a situation, it can look bad, you know, like a skull and crossbones. It can look dangerous. It can look poisonous. But if you take a moment to discuss it, work through it, talk about it, it can end up being okay. It can end up being funny. You can laugh at it. So it's really an optimistic image that hides out. And actually, a lot of my friends and collectors that come to shows, it's become Where's Waldo. They'll come into the show and they'll say, how many are there? And I'll have to say, oh, 15 or 16. I count
them.
Find them
all.
Exactly.
Scavenger hunt.
And many people will go through the gallery space and they won't stop till they found them all. Then they'll come back to me and tell me they found them. And then they'll go look at the work as like a body of work, you know? So it's really interesting. It's been really fun to watch people engage with the artwork that way.
That's so cool. It's kind of like your personal emblem of, there's power in having applied that to the bowling bags because you look more organized than maybe you guys really were.
Yeah.
But also hope.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Sharon Gamble with artist Pete Brown. Pete's show in partnership with Bosma Enterprises is called Blind, Visualize Without Your Eyes. And it opens at 6 p.m. on Friday, October 5th at Gallery 924. That's the Arts Council's gallery at 924 North Pennsylvania Street. You can learn more at bosma.org or brownbulb.com. That's Bosma, BOSMA.org or brownbulb.com. Brown, the color brown, and then BULB.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. A unique partnership between Indianapolis Museum of Art members and staff since 1962, the Contemporary Art Society, or CAS, has promoted the understanding, appreciation, and collection of contemporary art. Travis DiNicola spoke with contemporary curator Sarah Green and the CAS's president, Michael Kaufman, to find out more about how the CAS is celebrating its 50th anniversary.
Sarah, Michael, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you both.
Great to see you.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. So 50 years, this is a pretty cool thing, but let's start out before we talk about the big celebration. For those who may not be familiar with it, what is the IMA's Contemporary Art Society? Who gets to go, Sarah?
I'll go. So the Contemporary Art Society is a group of individuals who formed in 1962, mm-hmm. 50 years ago, and their goal was to bring contemporary art to the Indianapolis Museum of Art, which was then the Heron Art Gallery,
right.
And to encourage the collecting of art of the present day. So they would buy new works and encourage people to buy new works to donate to the IMA and to raise money for annual contributions. So they have basically founded contemporary art at the IMA.
So, I mean, as we look at art that the IMA has on exhibit from essentially the past 50 years or so, more or less, is most of that attributable to the Contemporary Art Society? I mean,
a lot of it is. And if you look closely at our gallery labels, they do call out the contributions of Contemporary Art Society. But we are adding a new sticker a little to each. It'll look better than your average sticker. But to each of the works next to the labels to really emphasize CAS's contribution.
So is this a small group, a big group? I mean, how do you get involved with it, Michael?
Yeah, right now we're at about 90 members, and it's just as easy as when you sign up for a membership of the museum, you can also designate an affiliate group that you'd like to be a part of. And so there are several affiliate groups at the IMACS, being one of them. The others include a horticulture, design society, there's a fashion arts, and there's Asian art. Yeah, several of them. And so the very easy to join. So we're, as part of this 50th year, very deliberately trying to expand our membership by an additional 50 members, and then also raise money for future acquisitions.
Okay. And that's a big part of course, what the society does, is raise money to acquire art. I mean, when you think of buying art for a museum, that's got to be awfully expensive to do. So there's more to it than just, like, the basic membership, I'm sure, that, like, makes that happen.
Correct. And it's not just the raising of the money. There's also ways for the members to get involved in the selection process. There's an acquisition process where members have a say in what, within a limited range of choices that have been vetted, but have that opportunity then to say, we want this piece here at our museum. And so it's a great way for people to actively participate in that acquisition process.
Yes, and we're actually gathering that group of people at the end of the year this year to participate in the selection committee process. And we'll actually be looking at works from our upcoming forefront show, Graphite. And it's all artists using graphite in new and innovative ways. So we will be taking the available works within that show, the works available for sale, talking about them, researching the artists, meeting together to look at them. And then from that group, the CAS selection committee will narrow it down to three potential purchases, and then the membership of CAS will vote on which ones they'll commit their funds to.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. Now, how does that work for you, Sarah, as a curator? I mean, this seems kind of unusual to have, a group of people that are that involved and that intimate in the process. Is that unusual? I mean, it sounds like it would be,
It's somewhat unusual, but we have a lot of faith in our membership. And the last time we went through this process, we emerged with Tim Hawkinson's Mobius Ship, which is in our galleries, and it's not a safe work. It was actually beyond the cost of what CAS had raised. So we committed to this piece with the assumption that people would step forward to contribute additional funds to it, and that happened. And I think it's a group of people who wants to do research about the artists, who wants to learn more about them, and we like opening it up.
Yeah. It sounds like the group surprised you a bit with that and challenged you a bit with that, yeah?
It did. But they are, as Michael said, they're all artists who we have stated that we would love to collect as an institution. There are countless artists who we would love to have as part of the collection. And so it's not too risky to give a list.
Yeah, and I think also that brings up another important aspect of CAS is the education process and the programming that we do. A large portion of CAS activity is highlighting IMA programming or also creating new programming, whether it be trips to other cities to see other galleries or other museums or home tours of contemporary collections and bringing in speakers. And so there has been a lot of activity that we've done to elevate the dialogue around contemporary art, both at the IMA and in the city. And so one of the things that I've emphasized with this 50th anniversary is that what I'm excited about is sort of taking a moment to celebrate where Indianapolis has come as a city in relationship to contemporary art, and that we as an organization can continue both to support the IMA, but also to support local contemporary art and other organizations, both large and small, who are pushing the frontiers of collecting and of education around art.
You mentioned the trips, and I know that I've heard some great stories about the trips to other museums and certainly to look at private collections. There's a real social aspect to this as well, it sounds like.
Yeah, certainly, and it's been a fun process. But you know,
I mean, not everyone who's in CAS is a curator or necessarily an artist, even, right?
Correct. Yeah, and it's definitely that chance for people to interact with other art lovers, or even if the curious. You know, that's what I would love to see CAS populated by is more just plain curious people who are maybe afraid of contemporary art, but this is a great way to engage in it in a very unintimidating way. And one of the events we did the end of last year, we had three local spoken word artists, hip-hop musicians, do freestyle interpretations of the contemporary art collection as part of our holiday party. And it was amazing to see this nice cross-section of people interacting who may not have otherwise have interacted, and to see the kind of the new ways of approaching contemporary art and the new ways of understanding contemporary art through that experience.
I actually think we formed a new art form through that event, because we've actually invited back the MCs to the Graphite opening on December 6th.
Dose and improvisation, right?
Yes. Nice. And in speaking with them, they described the process. I don't know. Do you want to say who they are?
Yeah, it's Alan Imagery, who's now going by Joseph Alan Woods, and Mr. Kinetic, and Tony Sticks. And I think we're going to invite another performer this year as well.
Yeah, so. But they said it was probably the most difficult thing they've ever done, and the most nerve-wracking. And there was a palpable energy in the room of nervous excitement when they began freestyle emceeing in front of, say, our Fred Sandback work. But it was fantastic. It was really exciting to sort of hear this interpretation, this new...
That sounds very cool.
Yeah.
Now, when is the Graphite show?
It is on... It opens on December 7th.
Okay. And
but
so you're having some of
them... There will be a party on Thursday, December 6th, and we're inviting them back, and it will be a free opening.
Nice.
So... please come out.
Now, of course, this weekend, as we're airing this on Art of the Matter, you also have a big event going on. It's actually an auction as well as a party and celebration. And I was looking online prior to the event at some of the work that's being auctioned off. There's some great stuff by great contemporary artists. Many have been shown or are in the permanent collection at the museum.
Yeah, when we decided to do this, you know, we thought we'd have some people who would support and give some pieces. But the overwhelming generosity of the people who support what the IMA is doing, it was a real testament, I think, to how the IMA is seen in the larger art world, that some very prestigious galleries and artists were very willing and very excited to give to this auction. Just, I think, again, speaks to what we're doing both here and beyond for the art world and for Indianapolis.
Yeah, and I think a lot of museums and art institutions have auctions as an annual event, and so they're very regularly hitting up their friends and fellow and artists who they've worked with for gifts of artwork, and we haven't done that.
No, I was thinking I couldn't remember ever an event where there was an art auction that was part of really any IMA event.
Right, yeah. And we didn't want to overdo it, and we didn't want to sort of over ask. But for this wonderful occasion of the 50th anniversary, it was something that we were ready to do, and then we couldn't have been happier with the response from artists and galleries. So this is really an unparalleled opportunity to buy top-rate artworks in Indianapolis.
Now, and who's handling the auction? Because it's a local auction house, right?
It is. It is Dan Ripley's Antique Helper. They have,
excellent.
They are helping us out and doing a wonderful job at that. So it will be part live, part silent. So if you're shy and don't care to raise your paddle in public, there will be other opportunities to purchase art as well.
So what other events are going on this year that are part of this 50th celebration, 50th anniversary? Anniversary celebration of the Contemporary Art Society?
Well, in addition to the Graphite Show and this new acquisition, we do the acquisition process every couple years, so it's nice that that falls on our 50th year. The signage and the labeling of existing acquisitions in the galleries is
part of that.
Right,
what Sarah was mentioning earlier?
Yep.
Okay.
This is sort of the main event, but definitely we are in the process as with CAS of trying to bring back some programming that we used to have as far as had more in a more robust way, which was some travel, some more of these site visits, and then also being more, I think, more deliberate, both working in collaboration between the museum staff and the CAS group about programming. So one of the new projects that we have that I'm pretty excited about is this program called Concentric Circles. And so these will include trips to, for instance, we're going to have one at the service center. So CAS members will have a private showing and engagement with Big Car and the service center and the art that will be going in during that time frame. And then we'll also, the idea of concentric circles going then out from beyond Indianapolis and trips to Cincinnati or Louisville. So those are that's a new program that we're really, it's more of a branding of an existing thing that we did, but a way to kind of grow that and to promote that.
So, Michael, how can someone who is interested in getting involved in CAS, you said you want 50 new members this year, how can I join?
Yeah, so you can actually go to the IMA website, and the URL is
imamuseum.org/CAS.
So pretty straightforward, and you can find a way to sign up there and learn more about CAS. And I just, again, encourage people. I mean, I think even if it's a one-time experience, you know, come celebrate with us by joining for 1 year and not looking for long-term commitment, but that chance to be challenged in a new way for 1 year about art and what art is.
And to have access to artists and opportunities and places in the city that you didn't even know existed.
Travis DiNicola with IMA Contemporary Curator Sarah Green and the Contemporary Art Society's President Michael Kaufman. To learn more about the CAS, visit imamuseum.org/CAS. Again, imamuseum.org/CAS. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Have you recovered from last weekend's festivals yet?
You mean the Festival of Festivals?
The Festival of Festivals.
It was a great weekend.
Sister Cities, Fiesta,
Irish Fest,
Jazz Fest.
What more do you want?
Well, I'll tell you, and so will you, on our calendar we call
What'll We Do?
So don't forget there are more festivals coming up, including one of your favorites.
That's right. Orange is this weekend. Saturday night starts at 8 o'clock and goes until 2 p.m. New location this year. It's up at the State Fairgrounds. It is a 21 and over event. Dozens of local artists will be not just setting up booths, but actually sort of environments that they create. Including Quincy Owens and Justin Vining, a lot of other great local artists, also fantastic bands. Rusty Redenbacher will be up there, and some bands I've not heard yet, including Mina and the Wondrous Flying Machine, Knife Fight, Squared Industries, The Weekenders, Dead Man's Switch, and Party Lines.
Well then,
good night, Sharon.
Well, I love it, and great promotion, especially of local music, which our listeners might have heard about. Rusty was on No Limits a week or two ago. Really fascinating conversation.
Yeah, if you've never been to Orange, it's in its 11th year. Absolutely worth checking out. It's one of the most interesting combinations of indoor arts festivals, music, rave, dance, party, just a great time. Definitely worth checking out Saturday night.
Very eclectic.
Yep.
Be there or be listening, as Matt would say.
Matt would say, what do you have?
Hey, this is not a festival, but it is a production that's gotten great acclaim, so it's a last call, too, so you need to act fast to score a ticket to Booth Tarkington Civic Theater's production of A Chorus Line. It is running through this Saturday, so get online fast. If you're thinking A Chorus Line, do I know any music for that? From that, What I Did for Love, One, and so many more tunes that you will recognize, even if you don't think you know any music from Chorus Line.
That's right. Great, great musical. Hey, Tuesday night, you know where I'm going, Sharon?
Is there beer?
There probably will be eventually. I am going up to the Center for the Performing Arts at the Palladium to check out a concert I never thought would be at the Palladium, and that is Blondie and Devo.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, 7:30 Tuesday night. I cannot wait. This is going to be a ton of fun.
Well, I mean, Blondie and Devo on the same ticket is weird enough, but...
At the Palladium.
At the Palladium.
What more do you want?
Yeah, I'm just thinking. I'm
Absolutely.
Expecting...
Tickets are still available.
Oh, I'm expecting a full report. Hey, there are so many great things going on. There is an exhibit that's about to open on Heron's campus. It's called Turnin' It, The Art and Culture of Drag. It features contemporary photography, costumes, and artifacts, all exploring gender identity. So, fascinating stuff, and you know that the Heron artists will give that an unusual twist. It's in the Heron School of Art and Design's Basile Gallery in Eskenazi Hall.
Hey, one thing that I've got, last thing, it also taking place at Heron, the Paper Cuts exhibit, which opens on September 26th, and this is an exhibit of a whole bunch of different international artists who are interpreting paper cutting in a really unique and contemporary way. Cannot wait to check this out. The exhibit deals with how paper cutting comes from China, but has certainly become a much more modern art form at Heron as well.
International's the segue to my last item, Russian folk dancing. You can learn about the different styles and interpretations of Russian and Cossack dances at Glendale Branch Library on Sunday, October 7th at 3 o'clock.
How cool is that?
It's very cool.
Well, we'll be back next week with more cool things to do on the calendar we call
What do we do? Festivals and all.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
The women of a certain age, Stutz artists are back, and they're on fire. Seriously, the October exhibit of mature female artists is called Women of a Certain Age on Fire. And it will feature 2D and 3D work of metal, paint on canvas, woodcut prints on paper, and acrostic. Sharon Gamble invited Lee Dunnington-Jones to our studios to see what lights her fire.
All right, you wacko women, women of a certain age, you're back at it. This is becoming an annual tradition, and I want you to talk to me about the conversation that resulted in the theme of this year's exhibition.
Well, it was kind of an accident. One of our members found a newspaper article about women on fire. And it was actually women fire performers.
Ah.
But the women on fire seemed to suit us so well. We've been so enthused with how we've had this will be our third exhibition, and we've had such good response to us in the 2 years previous that we are so excited about the third, and we are on fire with our enthusiasm.
So remind us of the themes of the first two.
Well, we first started with voices in 2010. It was voices, women of a certain age. It was about finding our voices. And the second one was last year, and it was In the Skin We're In. And in conjunction with that exhibit, we did a calendar of 12 of our women posed in as much unclothed as that was comfortable for them. Mm-hmm. And then we took a piece of their art and melded the two together, so we ended up with a third thing. And it was a beautiful calendar. We raised $6,700. We were able to give our partner, Pink Ribbon Connection, $1,200. So that's pretty good for 10 old women, I think.
10 grown-up women, please.
Yes. So, from finding our voices, we're going now to voicing our passion, and we're using fire as a symbol of our passion. So, there will be many fire-themed artworks, but the passion can be expressed in any form. If your passion is love, if your passion is your home, is your art. So that's what it's all about. It's about us creating art past middle age and still being fired up about it.
It strikes me that for someone who is making jewelry, that in particular, that's particularly apt because you are using heat sometimes.
Oh, and I am on fire. I've grown up to a real blowtorch.
Gee, I should have invited your husband on. I'm sure he'd have a comment about that.
But describe your metal work. How does it work for somebody who's never seen a studio? How does it work?
My work is in metal clay, and it is a powdered metal mixed with a medium and some moisture, water. And I can work it like a clay, which means I can sculpt it just like I would a ceramic clay, or I can push it into a mold. Many ways I can cut it, I can press it into something in any way that I want to create something, depending on my idea for the time. And then when it's done, I put it in high heat in a kiln, and the medium burns away, and I end up with bronze or metal or silver, depending on which clay that I'm working with. And I use all three metals. I work in all three. And it's really, really interesting. In the last year, I have been taking my pieces that I made with the metal clay and using glass enamel to give them color, which does require a torch. I started out with this little bitty butane torch, and then I graduated to a two-gas torch. And
wait,
now,
any mishaps along the way?
Burned my arm once, but I don't think I'll ever do that again.
Yeah.
Reached across the flame.
Ooh, ouch.
Learned my lesson.
And you started to say you've worked your way up to, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm using oxygen and acetylene now because I'm constructing things, soldering, welding things together. So I take my metal pieces and I put them together with this other method, which is requires fire.
I'm trying to picture it. How do you protect your studio? I mean,
carefully.
Yeah.
I wear, there's so much stuff in my studio, soot and metal filings, and I can't wear a mask because it doesn't fit my face. So I wear a bandana. I look like a bandit. So I've got these goggles and my bandana, and I have a metal-backed area where I can use my torch and be safe, and I have metal on my work table and fire bricks to work on so that I don't burn up everybody. Some of my other wackas do worry about me, though.
They come peek in on you occasionally.
They come and check and make sure I'm okay.
If you don't hear from me in an hour, come look in my door. So so you're applying the torch to this material. How long does it stay workable after you turn the torch off, or do you have to work it in the flame of the torch?
Well, by the time I get to the torch, the metal is already made.
Okay.
It's come out of the kiln as the piece.
I see. Okay.
And then if I want to add color to it, I use a powdered glass enamel, and that's where the torch comes in.
Got it. How do you...
And then welding pieces together. I need a torch for that.
Right. And then do you have to refire them in the kiln, or no, then they're done?
Then they're done.
How do you sketch always beforehand, or do you
sometimes
create
I do,
in the moment?
Lots of times I create in the moment. I do both. Make a little sketch, and sometimes I just start making something. I love found items, and I will make a mold of a found item and then make it out of metal, and then I leave it over here on my work table for a while until I live with it and it calls to me, and then I put it together with something.
Give me an example of a found item.
Wood. I love wood, different textures of wood. I should have brought one to show you. Especially wood that's been around for a while, and so the bark is worn off, and there's little woodpecker marks in it. So I made a piece of bronze about an inch and a half wide with the impression of this wood, and it had the wormholes running through it, and I filled the wormholes with copper.
Ooh.
And when I finished that piece, it was of a shape. It was about 3 inches long, 2 inches long, 2.5. It was of a shape that looked like a sarcophagus to me. And so I took one of my other pieces that I had molded, which happened to be a silver Egyptian profile, and put them together and called them Goddess of the Wood. It just happened that way.
Wow.
And it was just a really neat piece. It didn't last very long. It went away pretty soon.
Why?
Somebody took it. I mean, somebody bought it.
Oh,
and
okay.
Took it away from my home. Oh. It's home.
Darn it. And that's the downside.
That's the downside.
Creating unique pieces, it will never be again. You are particularly attracted to if this were a leaf, it would be called a chordate leaf. It's heart shapes. You're wearing right now a necklace that looks like either overlapping hearts or overlapping angel's wings. And one of your bracelets is overlapping little hearts that are actually leaves. Is there some... Did something happen that
made
that shape?
I grew up in the woods.
Okay, there it is.
I grew up in the woods, so I've always been attracted to all things natural. One of the pieces that I'm going to make for this exhibit is bronze trees, and I've used actual tree bark to form the skins of the trees. They're going to be small, and they're going to be mounted on, and the trees have their arms in the air. I found twigs in my yard that come from a walnut tree, and they have two branches and a twig and a Y.
Mm-hmm.
And at the base of the V that forms the Y, there's a little knob, and it looks like a head. Oh. And I looked at these, and I thought, these are women
little
dancing.
People. Sure.
These are women dancing, waving their arms. And so I'm making these trees, sculpting, reproducing these trees, and I'm going to mount them on a bank of coal.
Ooh.
So I'll have three bronze trees, and the title of the piece is going to be When I'm Low, My Sisters Dance for Me.
Aww. Oh, how lovely.
Titles are important to me because my pieces are important, I feel they deserve a title. This one that I'm wearing that you commented on could either be Angel's Wings or Hearts Overlapped. And it was made in particular as a gift of love. And I made one for myself also.
Good
but
for
it
you.
Is it's called Heart of My Heart.
Mm.
It's a lotus with a clear faceted stone in the middle of the lotus,
mm-hmm.
in the middle of the heart with the angel wings.
Mm. Beautiful. The exhibition you had a fun journey last year through the calendar, but you're something a little different this year. Fun, yes. You heard the quotation marks around that because I know that truly was a journey.
It was a journey.
About the beautiful women artists reconciling themselves about how they felt about exposing their bodies and how much to expose and in what way. You're doing something a little different this year.
Yes. Yes, we are. We came to this idea probably in February, maybe it was March, and so we've been gelling, percolating.
Mm-hmm.
And then in June or July, we started meeting again, and that's what makes this group so special, is we meet once a month or twice a month, and we talk about our work and how we feel about our work and how we feel about the theme. And we just have so many ideas bouncing across one another. That it's an inspiration to each other, that I'm making a sculpture this year, which is something that I don't usually do. And another jewelry artist that's one of our WACCAs is making sculptures. So we're pushing ourselves into different directions. We're going to have encaustic in this exhibit. We're going to have a freestanding sculpture.
Ooh.
We're going to have woodblock prints. We're going to have paint. We're going to have multimedia. It's going to be a big variety of different kinds of art, and all of us are exploring new avenues.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when you get to be past 50, you could get to be stodgy, but we're not.
I think that might be the last word we'd use to describe this group. You're also doing a little fundraising project to support Pink Ribbon Connection, and this year.
Yes, we are. Bonnie Fillenworth is a woman artist in our building. She's a young woman, so she doesn't qualify as a WACCA, but we have dubbed
her... Could she be a WACCA in training?
She could be.
Okay.
We have dubbed her honorary WACCA, but her entire work is about the fight of breast cancer.
Wow.
And she's going to make us a special painting, which we will have on view in our exhibit, and it will be for sale, but she's given us permission to have this painting reprinted on note cards, so we can sell those to benefit Pink Ribbon Connection.
Terrific.
And what else was I going to say about that? She's a very talented and devoted young woman, and she is a WACA in training. We've got her under our wing.
Hey, I want to ask you to give some words of encouragement, because somebody listening might be thinking, that's a woman interviewing a woman. Can guys come to this?
Oh, guys can come to this, and guys should come to this. We get guys and we get gals, and each piece of art will have a little 500-word story behind it, and then all of the WACAs will be there. So what this event does usually for us is to encourage a dialogue about why the piece was made, how the artist feels, how that coincides with how you might feel or how your wife might feel. We have so many special things planned for our October the 5th opening. We're going to have two young women as perform with fire.
Yeah,
and
tell
dancers.
Me about that.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
So, with torches, or how does it work?
It works by, I don't know exactly how it works. It's just beautiful. The artist has a pot of fire hanging from her hands on
Ooh.
Chains, and she does a ballet. And the lights are lowered, and it's, you know, kind of like when you have a match in the dark or your sparkler or whatever, and you can watch the trails. And the music is surreal, and it's just, so we have two of them, and they're going to do two performances on October the 5th, two 15-minute performances between the hours of 6 and 9. So that's going to be a really exciting thing that I encourage people to see. One of our young women, her name is Polly. Her mother is a breast cancer survivor, so this was a very special event for her to participate in. So it's amazing to me, in the 3 years of doing this, how many people we touch that we don't even know that we do touch. And then when those connections are made, it just kind of gives me goosebumps.
Sharon Gamble with Lee Dunnington-Jones. Lee is one of nearly a dozen women artists who call themselves women of a certain age, that's WACAs, and who are part of the Stutz Artists Association. The WACAs are opening Women of a Certain Age on Fire on Friday, October 5th at the Stutz Artist Space Gallery in the Stutz Building, with a reception featuring cheese and wine, two female fire performers, and several artists talking at 7 p.m. about their work and their life experiences. After the opening, you can view the show from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Thursdays and Fridays in October, or by appointment. Get more information at stutzartists.com. Again, Stutz, S-T-U-T-Z, artists.com. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra, from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4, when I'll get a preview of the Indianapolis Scottish Highland Games and Festival.
I'll find out what's new for the arts education organization Arts for Learning. Plus, we'll have that calendar of events we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.